Anthropology, in general, is the scientific study of humans, human behavior, and societies in the past and present. Social anthropology is the branch that studies patterns of behavior. Cultural anthropology focuses on cultural meaning, and physical anthropology examines the biological development of humans and the segment that has experienced the most dramatic changes of the past decade, with advances in genomics and the sequencing of not only modern genomes, but unlocking the secrets of ancient DNA as well. Where in the not-so-distant past, anthropologists, historians, and religious scholars would have heated debates over the ethnic origins of humanity's earliest civilizations, we can now, thanks to genetic analysis, come to a definitive consensus over the identities of our ancient forefathers, with the same degree of certainty used in court providing paternity tests or forensic evidence used in convicting someone of a crime. That said, scientists have been publishing their findings concerning some of the most exciting eras of history, from the identity of ancient Egyptian mummies to unlocking the details concerning biblical stories known by billions of people worldwide. The tombs of ancient Egypt have yielded golden collars and ivory bracelets, but another treasure, human DNA, has proved elusive. Now, scientists have captured sweeping genomic information from Egyptian mummies. It reveals that mummies were closely related to ancient Middle Easterners, hinting that Northern Africans might have different genetic roots from the people south of the Sahara Desert. The study, published on 30 May in Nature Communications, includes data from 90 mummies buried between 1380 BC during Egypt's New Kingdom and AD 425 in the Roman era. The findings show that the mummies' closest kin were ancient farmers from a region that includes present-day Israel and Jordan. Modern Egyptians, by contrast, have inherited more of their DNA from Central Africans. Archaeological discoveries and historical documents suggest close ties between Egypt and the Middle East, but it is very nice that this study has now provided empirical evidence for this at the genetic level, says evolutionary anthropologist Omar Kokuman of the State University of New York at Buffalo. The latest analysis succeeded by bypassing soft tissue, often abundant in Egyptian mummies, to seek DNA from bone and teeth. Researchers carefully screened the DNA to rule out contamination from anyone who had handled the mummies since their excavation a century ago in the ancient town of Abusir el Melek. More than half of the mummies we studied had pretty decent DNA preservation, says co-author Johannes Kraus, a paleogeneticist at the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History in Jena, Germany. The team succeeds where previous studies on Egyptian mummies have failed or fallen short, says Hans Schroeder, a paleogeneticist at the University of Copenhagen. Now, researchers can hope to answer questions such as whether immigration drove ancient Egyptian population growth, adds Sonia Sakrowski, a bioarchaeologist at the University of Southampton, UK. The scientists obtained information about variations in mitochondrial DNA, which is passed from mother to child from 90 mummies. Because of contamination, the team was able to acquire detailed nuclear DNA, which is inherited from both parents from only 3 mummies. Both types of genomic material showed that ancient Egyptians shared little DNA with modern sub-Saharan Africans. Instead, their closest relatives were people living during the Neolithic and Bronze Ages in the area known as the Levant. Strikingly, the mummies were more closely related to ancient Europeans and Anatolians than to modern Egyptians. The researchers say that there was probably a pulse of sub-Saharan African DNA into Egypt roughly 700 years ago. The mixing of ancient Egyptians and Africans from further south means that modern Egyptians can trace 8% more of their ancestry to sub-Saharan Africans than can the mummies from Abusir el-Malik. The new data can't explain why the ancient Egyptians were so tightly aligned with people from the Middle East. Was it the result of migration, or were the Stone Age hunter-gatherers of northern Africa genetically similar to those of the Levant? It's too early to tell, Krauss said, but there's a better chance now of getting answers. This is the first glimpse of the genetic history of Egypt, he says, but it's really just the start. So the DNA confirms that the ancient Egyptians shared genetic affinities with Europeans, Anatolians, and fair-skinned people of the ancient Middle East. That would make sense, as not only are the ancient Egyptian mummies blonde or red-haired, the ancient Egyptian statues of their pharaohs and nobility have blue eyes. The same deep blue eyes we find in ancient Sumerian statues of their gods and nobility. More validation comes again by way of genetics, by recent published studies carried out by an international team of researchers led by scientists from the Sackler Faculty of Medicine in Tel Aviv University, the Institute for Galilean Archaeology, Kinneret College, the Israeli Antiquities Authority, and Harvard University. Blue-eyed, fair-skinned settlers inhabited the Levant some 6,500 years ago, according to an international, interdisciplinary team of scientists. An article released Monday in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Communications solves the mystery of how Chalcolithic culture got to the Galilee via population migration. When they mapped the genomes of bones from 22 of the 600 individual skeletons discovered in a massive necropolis near Pekin in north of the country, the scientists found a genetic mix quite unlike that of previous and successive settlers to the region. In the article, ancient DNA from Chalcolithic Israel reveals the role of population mixture in cultural transformation. The scientists concluded that the homogeneous community found in the cave could source 57% of its ancestry from groups related to those of the local Levant Neolithic, 26% from groups related to those of the Anatolian Neolithic, and 17% from groups related to those of the Iran Chalcolithic. The genetic analysis provided an answer to the central question we set out to address, said Harvard's Reich. It showed that the Pekin people had substantial ancestry from northerners, similar to those living in Iran and Turkey, that was not present in earlier Levantine farmers. The Chalcolithic era, also dubbed the Copper Age, follows the Stone Age and precedes the Bronze Age. There are already several DNA analyses for Bronze Age settlement in the Levant, including last summer's publication of research from Bronze Age burials that shows that 93% of the ancestry of modern Lebanese ancestry comes from the Canaanites. Now, the new Pekin genome mapping fills in a void of 3,000 years of DNA analysis. With the new study's conclusion that some half of the indigenous Chalcolithic people's genomes derive from ancient Turkey and Iran, it appears that these artifacts may have arrived during migration and were not merely as the byproducts of a trade route as previously suggested. The scientists uncovered some recessive genetic traits not usually expected in human remains from the Levant. Certain characteristics, such as blue eye color, were not seen in the DNA test results of earlier Levantine human remains, said May. The blue-eyed, fair-skinned community didn't continue, but at least now researchers have an idea why. These findings suggest that the rise and fall of the Chalcolithic culture are probably due to demographic changes in the region, said May. As I've covered in my previous videos, the 4,000-year-old mummified remains found in China of 6-foot-6-inch tall, blonde, Aryan-looking people near those massive pyramids that the Chinese government still tries to conceal from satellite imagery by planting trees on top of them, are also from Iran. Not Ireland, not Germany, it's the other way around. They are Aryans from Iran that entered into Europe, the same way they entered India, entered Egypt, and even entered Ethiopia. As Herodotus tells us, the ancient Ethiopians were the fairest of all men. It is clear that the demographics that populate the world today, in most cases, are very different than what it was thousands of years ago. And the politically motivated professors and media should spend some time doing their job and teaching facts instead of social engineering and pushing cultural Marxist fairy tales. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. Please consider reading my published books available on Amazon. You can support my ongoing efforts with a donation on Patreon. There should be a link below. Thank you to those who share my videos, as I rely on word of mouth. And please don't forget to leave a comment. Your thoughts are valued and appreciated. Make sure you subscribe and hit the notification bell for updates, and I hope to see you again soon. Around 500 BC, ancient Greece was comprised of two primary city-states that could be considered superpowers of their day, Athens and Sparta. The Athenians enjoyed a period of naval supremacy in the Mediterranean Sea and was a place where democracy, art, and philosophy flourished. The Spartans, on the other hand, were a militaristic society considered by historians to be among the most elite land-based fighting armies at their prime. Around 480 BC, these two rivals joined forces and teamed up to defend Greece from a common enemy, the invading Persian Empire. While the Spartans fought valiantly, as documented in movies such as 300, and the Athenians won decisive naval battles, the mighty Persian army still managed to burn down the sacred temples to the gods on the Athenian Acropolis. The Persians were eventually forced to abandon their invasion, and what followed was the Golden Age of classical Greece, which lasted for about 50 years, before Greece fell back into internal wars between the Greek city-states. After about a century of fighting, ancient Greece became depleted and vulnerable, this time to a new rising power to the north, the Macedonians. Under King Philip II, Macedonia emerged as a formidable military force, due in large part to being well-trained, but also introducing a new type of weapon to the battlefield, an 18-foot-long pike called a sarissa, twice the length of a normal Greek spear, that proved to give a definitive advantage over the standard phalanx, the name given to the most common military formation at the time. In 338 BC, King Philip's army crushed the joint army of Thebes and Athens, uniting Greece, except for Sparta, under what became known as the Hellenic League. King Philip was assassinated by his own bodyguard and was succeeded by his 20-year-old son, Alexander, who was tutored by none other than Aristotle himself, and already experienced in the art of war. Alexander consolidated power by crushing his rivals and proceeded to invade Persia by 334 BC with an army of about 40,000. Victoriously penetrating into Asia Minor, finally confronting King Darius, King of Kings himself, whose army outnumbered Alexander's 2-1. Despite the numbers Alexander achieved a stunning victory, massacring the Persian army, with King Darius fleeing in retreat, but Alexander capturing the king's wife, mother, and three children. Alexander went on to conquer the Phoenician coastal cities, continuing to Egypt, conquering everything in his path, and declared Pharaoh by the priests of Memphis. He then founded a new city, named it Alexandria, and eventually went on to establish another dozen cities, all bearing his name. Alexander marched eastward, conquering territory that extended to the ends of the known world at the time. But while there's a lot more to the story, I would like to now read a letter from Alexander the Great to Darius, king of Persia. And I quote, "Your ancestors invaded Macedonia and the rest of Greece and did us harm, although we had not done you any previous injury. I have been appointed commander-in-chief of the Greeks, and it is with the aim of punishing the Persians that I have crossed into Asia, since you are the aggressors. You gave support to the people of Perinthus, who had done my father harm, and Aucis sent a force to Thrace, which was under our rule. My father died at the hand of conspirators instigated by you, as you yourself boasted to everybody in your letters. You killed Arsus with the help of Bogas and gained your throne through unjust means, in defiance of Persian custom and doing wrong to the Persians. You sent unfriendly letters to the Greeks about me to push them to war against me, and sent money to the Spartans and some other Greeks, which none of the other cities would accept apart from the Spartans. Your envoys corrupted my friends and sought to destroy the peace which I established among the Greeks. I therefore led an expedition against you, and you started the quarrel. But now I have defeated in battle first your generals, and now you in person, and your army, and by the grace of the gods I control the country. All those who fought on your side and did not die in battle but came over to me, I hold myself responsible for them. They are not on my side under duress, but are taking part in the expedition of their own free will. Approach me, therefore, as the Lord of all Asia. If you are afraid of suffering harm at my hands by coming in person, send some of your friends to receive proper assurances. Come to me and ask and receive your mother, your wife, your children, and anything else you wish. Whatever you can persuade me to give shall be yours. In future, whenever you communicate with me, send to me as King of Asia. Do not write to me as an equal, but state your demands to the master of all your possessions. If not, I shall deal with you as a wrongdoer. If you wish to lay claim to the title of king, then stand your ground and fight for it. Do not take flight, as I shall pursue you wherever you may be." End quote. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. You can find my published books on Amazon. You can support my work with a donation on Patreon. There should be a link in the description. Thank you to those that share these videos, as I rely on word of mouth. Please don't forget to subscribe, hit like, and let me know your thoughts in the comment section. And I hope to see you again soon. Have a great weekend. The Muses inspired Hesiod to write the 800-line epic poem called Works and Days. In it, Hesiod tells a Greek creation story that traces the lineage of mankind through five successive ages or races. The most ancient is the Golden Age, the only age that falls within the rule of Cronos. It is said that it was a time when people lived among the gods and freely mingled with them. Peace and harmony prevailed during this age. Humans did not have to work to feed themselves, for the earth provided food in abundance. They lived to a very old age, but with a youthful appearance, and eventually died peacefully. Their spirits lived on as guardians. Plato recounts the golden race of men who came first, and he clarifies that Hesiod did not mean men were literally made of gold, but were good and noble and held integrity and virtue in high regard. He describes these men as demons upon the earth. Demons in this context comes from an ancient Greek sense meaning knowing or wise or divine principle. They are beneficent, preventing ills, and guardians of mortal men. So please don't confuse the meaning with more modern negative connotations. The next age is called the Silver Age. The Silver Age and every age that follows fall within the rule of Cronos' successor and son, Zeus. Men in the Silver Age lived for 100 years under the dominion of their mothers. They lived only a short time as grown adults and spent that time in strife with one another. During this age, men refused to worship the gods, and Zeus destroyed them for their impiety. After death, humans of this age became blessed spirits of the underworld. Next is the Bronze Age. Men of the Bronze Age were hard. War was their purpose and passion. Not only arms and tools, but their very homes were forged of bronze. The men of this age were undone by their own violent ways and left no named spirits, but dwell in the dank house of Hades. It came to an end with a massive flood. Now you'll notice that each age gets progressively worse to this point. Life spans are shorter, and life itself is more difficult or challenging. So we started with gold, then silver, then bronze, and we'll eventually get to the Iron Age, but not yet. In between the Bronze Age and the Iron Age is what is called the Heroic Age. The Heroic Age is the one age that does not correspond with any metal. It is also the only age that improves upon the age it follows. In this period, men lived with noble demigods and heroes. It was the heroes of this age who fought at Thebes and Troy. This race of humans died and went to Elysium. Elysium would also be known as the Fortunate Isles or Islands of the Blessed, located in the Western Ocean at the end of the Earth. And now we finally get to the Iron Age. Hesiod finds himself in the Iron Age, and during this age, humans live to an existence of toil and misery. Children dishonor their parents, brother fights with brother, and the social contract between guest and host is forgotten. During this age, might makes right, and bad men use lies to be thought of as good. At the height of this age, humans no longer feel shame or indignation at wrongdoing, and the gods will have completely forsaken humanity, and I quote, "There will be no help against evil," end quote. For those who have followed my work, I place the arrival or sudden appearance of Cro-Magnon as the time of the heroic age, which I've said is the only age that improves upon the age it follows. So each age follows a sort of devolution or degradation until the heroic age. And anthropologically speaking, it is with Cro-Magnon that we see a sudden leap in tool technology, art, animal domestication, and everything else we associate with civilization compared to other hominids of the Pleistocene. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. I want to thank all my supporters on Patreon and those who share these videos. Thank you. I rely on word of mouth. Please check out my published work available on Amazon. My books make a great gift. I love reading your insightful comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. And don't forget to subscribe for updates. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. And Buffy and I hope to see you again soon. In the US, we are taught at an early age that Thomas Edison was probably the greatest inventor who ever lived. There is no argument that he created some of the most spectacular technology the world has ever seen. He certainly did hold more than 1,000 patents. However, it appears that he may have gone to any length to claim credit for inventions of other people's work and creativity. Edison gets credit for the fluoroscope. This was a device which first made X-rays possible and also added to Edison's growing wealth. The problem is that the actual inventor of a device to see the bones of a human was a German scientist named William Röntgen, who took an X-ray of his wife's hand several years prior to Edison's fluoroscope. Edison was more than happy not to correct the error. Another concept Edison is given credit for is creating devices for recording speech and other forms of sound. A French printer and bookseller named Edward Leon Scott de Martinville created his phonautograph more than 15 years before Edison's 1877 invention of the phonograph. Again, Thomas Edison made no mention of Martinville when marketing his own device. Many people regard Edison as the father of motion pictures. However, there's a fairly solid argument that Louis Le Prince created a working motion picture before Edison, but when traveling to America to patent it, he got on a train and nobody saw him again. His son continued with the patent request and eventually testified against Edison, but someone shot him, so Edison got the lucrative patent. There's no doubt, however, that Edison was a great businessman and knew how to manipulate the press in his favor. You probably heard about the famous rivalry between Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison, where Edison electrocuted cats, dogs, and even an elephant to make Tesla's AC/DC technology seem more dangerous than his own direct current technology. What most people are not aware of, however, is that Edison was very interested in the afterlife, entranced with it, in fact, and in his eyes, life after death was not the way perhaps many envision it. His theory was that there was basically a set amount of life in the universe, and that it could not be created or destroyed, much like the conservation of energy or mass law in thermodynamics. This life, he surmised, came in the form of myriads of infinitesimal entities, each a separate consciousness, which acted much like atoms do with matter, forming the smallest building blocks of life as we know it. According to him, the individual consciousnesses in each person were made up of unique patterns of these tiny entities, which grouped together in swarms within the brain to form our soul. He believed that death came when these tiny entities disagreed, and that they could go on into existence beyond the physical body. In Edison's own words, and I quote, I believe that life, like matter, is indestructible. There has always been a certain amount of life in this world, and there will always be the same amount. You cannot create life, you cannot destroy life, you cannot multiply life. I believe our bodies are composed of myriads and myriads of entities, each in itself a unit of life, which band together to build a man. In our bodies, these entities constantly rebuild our tissues to replace those which are constantly wearing out. They watch after functions of the various organs, just as the engineers in a powerhouse see that the machinery is kept in perfect order. Once conditions in the body become unsatisfactory in the body, either through a fatal sickness, fatal accident, or old age, the entities simply depart from the body and leave little more than an empty structure behind. Being diligent workers, they naturally seek something else to do. They either enter into the body of another man or even start to work on some other form of life. At any rate, there's a fixed amount of these, and it is the same entities that have served over and over again. They fight out their differences, and then the stronger group takes charge. If the minority is willing to be disciplined and to conform, there is harmony. But minorities sometimes say, "To hell with this place, let's get out of it." They refuse to do their appointed work in the man's body, he sickens and dies, and they are all free to seek out new experiences somewhere else. When we die, these swarms of units, like a swarm of bees, so to speak, betake themselves elsewhere and go on to functioning in some other form or environment. There are many indications that we human beings act as a community rather than as units. That is why I believe that each of us comprises millions upon millions of entities, and that our body and our mind represent the vote or voice, whichever you wish to call it, of our entities. The entities live forever. Death is simply the departure of the entities from our body. If the units of life which compose an individual's memory hold together after death, is it not within range of possibility, to say the least, that these memory swarms could retain the powers they formerly possessed and thus retain what we call the individual's personality after dissolution of the body? I'm hopeful that by providing the right kind of instrument to be operated by this personality, we can receive intelligent messages from it in its changed habitation or environment. End quote. Edison surmised that if these particles of consciousness could be arranged back into their prior harmony, then that dead person's consciousness would be essentially resurrected. It was his guess that some sort of photographic plate could be used to record the precise layout of these entities and serve as a sort of snapshot to the personality that had passed on, allowing them to be put back together again. Edison apparently spent a lot of effort trying to prove that these theoretical particles existed, gathering a team of scientists to test out a machine that could detect them, and trying to craft a device that could be used to communicate with personalities that had passed from the world of the living. He would, in October of 1920, give a rather spectacular announcement to the media saying that he had been working on an apparatus that would be able to contact the dead, which would go on to be called the spirit phone. It is unknown just how far along Edison was on an actual device to talk to spirits, but Nikola Tesla was also developing a similar device at the same time. Both men were racing to create something that picked up on the frequencies of discarnate spirits, what today is called EVP, or electronic voice phenomenon. Nikola Tesla thought that the universe was composed of an infinite variety of sound and electromagnetic waves, and that if you could zero in on the right ones, you could hear the voices of the departed. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. You can find my published work on Amazon. Please don't forget to subscribe, hit like, share, and leave your thoughts in the comment section. Thank you for listening, and I hope to see you again soon. Whenever I feel like just getting away, whether to think about something specific or to just reflect on life itself, I often find myself coming back to the beach. There's just something about the fresh air and looking out across the endless blue ocean that expands my mind and helps me to open up to new possibilities that just seem more difficult to do when I'm cooped up indoors staring at four walls. And on this sunny day in California, I started wondering about what happens after we die. Where do we go? Somewhere specific? Nowhere at all? A heaven or hell? Or maybe reincarnation? Although I've come across many theories, I can't say for sure, and I'm not sure that anyone else living knows with absolute certainty either. That said, Mr. Alan Watts offers an interesting concept for us to ponder. Let's have a listen.
Just in the same way as you don't focus your attention on how you make your thyroid gland function, so in the same way you don't have any attention focused on how you shine the sun. So then, let me connect this with the problem of birth and death, which puzzles people enormously, of course. Because in order to understand what the self is, you have to remember that it doesn't need to remember anything. Just like you don't need to know how you work your thyroid gland. So then, when you die, you're not going to have to put up with everlasting non-existence, because that's not an experience. A lot of people are afraid that when they die, they're going to be locked up in a dark room forever. And sort of undergo that. But one of the most interesting things in the world, this is a yoga, this is a way of realization. Try and imagine what it will be like to go to sleep and never wake up. Think about that. Children, think about it. It's one of the great wonders of life. What will it be like to go to sleep and never wake up? And if you think long enough about that, something will happen to you. You will find out, among other things, that it'll pose the next question to you. What was it like to wake up after having never gone to sleep? That was when you were born. You see, you can't have an experience of nothing. Nature abhors a vacuum. So after you're dead, the only thing that can happen is the same experience, or the same sort of experience, as when you were born. In other words, we all know very well that after people die, other people are born. And they're all you. Only you can only experience it one at a time. Everybody is I. You all know you're you. And wheresoever beings exist throughout all galaxies, it doesn't make any difference. You are all of them. And when they come into being, that's you coming into being. You know that very well. Only you don't have to remember the past in the same way you don't have to think about how you work your thyroid gland or whatever else it is in your organism. You don't have to know how to shine the sun. You just do it. Like you breathe. Isn't it? Doesn't it really astonish you that you are this fantastically complex thing? And that you're doing all of this and you never had any education in how to do it? You never learned, but you're this miracle? Well, the point is that from a strictly physical, scientific standpoint, this organism is a continuous energy with everything else that's going on. And if I am my foot, I am the sun.
It's a very deep concept, hard to totally get my mind around. If true, it would mean that every amazing experience, every lottery winner, every first date or wedding, and likewise every case of suffering and illness and even murder, all those experiences we would all experience. And the next thought is how it gives a literal interpretation of karma, since everything you put out is literally and ultimately directly experienced by another version of self. Let's consider the implications a little further.
Let's suppose that you were able every night to dream any dream you wanted to dream. And that you could, for example, have the power within one night to dream 75 years of time, or any length of time you wanted to have. And you would naturally, as you began on this adventure of dreams, you would fulfill all your wishes. You would have every kind of pleasure you could conceive. And after several nights of 75 years of total pleasure each, you would say, well, that was pretty great. But now let's have a surprise. Let's have a dream which isn't under control. Well, something is going to happen to me that I don't know what it's going to be. And you would dig that and come out of that and say, wow, that was a close shave, wasn't it? And then you would get more and more adventurous, and you would make further and further out gambles as to what you would dream. And finally, you would dream where you are now. You would dream the dream of living the life that you are actually living today. That would be within the infinite multiplicity of choices you would have, of playing that you weren't God. Because the whole nature of the Godhead, according to this idea, is to play that he's not. The first thing he says to himself is, man, get lost. Because he gives himself away. The nature of love is self-abandonment, not clinging to oneself. Throwing yourself out, as in, for example, in basketball, you're always getting rid of the ball. You say to the other fellow, have a ball. See? And that keeps things moving. That's the nature of life. So in this idea, then, everybody is fundamentally the ultimate reality, not God in a politically kingly sense, but God in the sense of being the self, the deep down basic whatever there is. And you're all that, only you're pretending you're not.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. You can find my published work on Amazon. My books make a great gift. Thank you so much to my subscribers on Patreon, as well as anyone who shares these videos. I really appreciate it and would like to invite you to subscribe to this channel for updates. Please don't forget to leave a comment and give a thumbs up for Mr. Alan Watts. I hope to see you again soon.